By all that we know, the Buddha and the people around him were exceptionally functional, engaged, insightful, and creative people who lived in the world. They didn't live in caves. They lived in the world, in community, always engaged. So we need to bear that context in mind when we hear then coming from the Buddha, there is no ear, no sound, no ear consciousness, no nose, no odor, no nose consciousness, no tongue, no flavor, no tongue consciousness, no body, no sensation, no body consciousness, no mind, no mind object, and no mind consciousness. It's impossible to point out the manifestation, a way of being beset by perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these unwholesome states cease without remainder. Now, how do you bring those two together? How do you bring those two together? What is the Buddha talking about? Any ideas?
It was interesting. I had a very interesting half hour thinking about this. I felt like a little kid trying to solve a puzzle of my lifetime. And anyhow, if he's not dead, the only thing in source, because as a human being, you have to have contact, and without the contact, I know I'm probably looking at it the wrong way, but it's enlightenment is what the only thing that I could think of.
Yeah. So the assumption is the only answer you could come up with. This is pointing towards some form of nirvana. It's the right answer, by the way. If anybody else was having doubts, that is the right answer. You passed the test. Good. Anna?
The only thing I could come up with was that maybe these eye consciousness and hearing consciousness, if I'm not identifying with those as being mine, if I'm not taking the world personally, I could still be alive but not be suffering. That's
yes, also the right answer. There's a lot of right answers here. Yeah. All of this could be going on, and if it's not surrounded by identification and self-making, it's still living, but it's the end of suffering, it's the end of struggle. Yes?
I came up with non-judging.
Mm-hmm, with non-judging.
What is it
you said? Non-judging, you said, yeah.
Everything is completely connected. If what we're experiencing is completely connected to everything else, then there's no differentiation.
No differentiation. So no for and against, no for and against, no hierarchies, no preferencing.
Yeah. I came up with, why is it so hard to get there?
Uh-huh. Well, that has something to do with that line of being delighting in and welcoming and clinging to has something to do with why it's so hard to get there. First obstacle is delighting in, welcoming and clinging to the world of our constructions. First primary obstacle to understanding. Very big one. Very, very big one. Yes.
That
the chain can be interrupted at any point to bring the whole chain to cessation. Yeah. If you remember that quote I used earlier on today, that on contact the world arises, and with the cessation of contact there's a cessation of the world. the cessation of the world, constructed world of experience. I think actually, I mean, all of you are actually pointing in absolutely the right direction. You know, the Buddha, this is actually a teaching on emptiness. This is actually a teaching on emptiness, which has, sorry, yeah? Still contact. This has nothing to do with appreciation. It has nothing to do with any of that. So this is actually a teaching on emptiness, okay? So the Buddha is actually not talking, the Buddha was not a nihilist. So he was not talking about annihilating our engagement with life. He was not talking, he did not recommend that people retreat to caves as a direct means to liberation. He did not talk about erasure. He did not talk about no self. He did not talk about any of these ways of kind of subjugating life or denying life. This is not what the Buddha was about. The Buddha was entirely concerned with ending suffering. The Buddha is entirely concerned with what it means to be awake as a human being and to live an embodied wakefulness, to embody wakefulness in everything, every aspect of our life. So the Buddha's not talking about annihilating contact. He's not talking about annihilating feeling. He's not talking about annihilating perception, because as long as we live, contact, feeling, perception is simply part of moving through the world and engaging with the world. What the Buddha is talking about is the end of suffering and its causes. So he is talking about stripping contact from the underlying tendencies and the self-making and the reifying and the solidifying. He's talking about stripping feeling of the underlying tendencies of greed and hatred and delusion. He's talking about stripping perception of all of the distortions that lead us to preferencing and to prejudice and to being for and against and to seeing permanence where there is no permanence and to imposing our views and conceit and aversions and cravings upon all things. So he's talking about stripping perception of distortion. If all of that is stripped of distortion, if all of that is stripped of those aspects that cause argument, that cause estrangement, that cause conflict and violence, then the chain certainly is interrupted. You know, papancha disappears. This dwelling upon and proliferating and world building, which is also self building, disappears. So the Buddha's pointing to many, many things, I think, in that one verse. He's talking about deconstruction. He's talking about how this world of conflict and this world of argument is a contingent world. It's a world contingent upon certain distortions being present. In that sense, it is no life sentence. So he's talking about deconstructing the chain and taking away any sense of inevitability. You know, he's talking about deconstructing the chain and the way that the chain can be deconstructed. He's talking about non-identification. That certainly is part of it. That this is not me, this is not who I am, this does not belong to me, this is not my world. He's talking about not centralizing self within all things, because without the centralization of self, there's very little for a constructed world to actually hang on. You know, there isn't anything for a constructed world to hang on without that primary centralization of self. He's actually talking about liberating the sense doors, liberating the eyes, the ears, the body, the mind, the taste, the touch. He's talking about liberating the sense doors from the distortions of craving and aversion. So, you know, when the Buddha was asked, you know, one time, he's asked this question all the time, you know, what is the essence of your teaching? And he keeps coming up with a different answer. But You know, one of the most famous answers is, in the seeing, there is just the seeing. In the hearing, there is just the hearing. In the tasting, there is just the tasting. In the touching, just the touching. In the thought, just the thought. So he's talking about actually liberating, not denying the sense doors, but liberating the sense doors from the ownership of me, of my sights, my seeing, my hearing, my thinking, my thoughts, my body. And that is actually what allows the whole non-preferencing, the non-biasing. In the seeing, there is just the seeing, liberated from all of the ways that we try and fix that in place through a view, and through a view formed on our preferences and our likes and dislikes. He's talking about not being a hostage to the world of conditions. You know, not pursuing contact as a means to my happiness and my capacity to avoid unhappiness. He's actually talking about liberating the world from our views. Remember that quote from Blake, "The world would appear as it is infinite." But the world would appear as it is, also fluid, dynamic, unfolding, that nothing is held rigid, nothing is held static. He's talking actually about the cessation of my world, the cessation of my world. That's a huge thing. But obviously, as we've talked about many, many times, over the weekend, you know, this is a process. It's a process of willingness. It's a process of investigation that requires ardency and resoluteness. It's a process of being willing to, you know, the Buddha was not into transcendence of the world, but he was very much very passionate about the transcendence of suffering. And it's also about, you know, we are sometimes willing to give up suffering and struggle and argument and brawling. We're not always quite so willing to give up the causes. The causes. Not quite so willing to give up the causes. You know, my preferences, my likes, my dislikes, my cravings, my aversions, my views. You know, we're not always quite so willing to give up the causes. So it's developing that kind of passion and ardency of that willingness, really, to renounce, to relinquish, to unbind from not only suffering, but the origins of suffering. It takes a diligence, mindfulness, you know. As you mentioned earlier, we really are asked to be attentive of what to what is going on within us and what is going on around us. And we are really asked, in a sense, to take ownership, but not in a territorial way, not an identified way. You know, the Buddha was so clear that we need to be a conscious participant in our own awakening. You know, that this is not something that is delivered to us by another. And only by being a conscious participant in our own awakening can we then really be a conscious participant in the awakening of our world. So there's much that is involved in this process, you know, and you see how much material we've gone into over this weekend. And every bit of it, you know, is a vantage point, and it's a doorway into understanding process. You know, there's not like this one right way, but you know, as the Buddha put it so clearly, you know, the path of awakening is rooted in the classroom of our lives. We have everything we need right here. You know, we don't have to try to have a body, we don't have to try to have a mind, you know, we probably don't have to try to have aversion and craving. You know, we probably don't have to try to have clinging and identification. We probably don't really have to try very hard at all to have papancha. You know, so it's kind of all here, isn't it? And it's a question of how much we turn towards that with the eyes of investigation rather than with the eyes of perception that is distorted by the underlying tendencies, the obsessions we lie down with. I think we need to take a remarkable amount of care about what we lie down with. You know, we'd probably all take a lot of care in our life about who we lie down with, but we have to take a lot of care about what we lie down with, you know. Because what we lie down with, you know, the more we practice at it, the better we get, you know. The more we lie down with aversion, the better we get at being aversive, you know. The more we lie down with doubt, it deepens. Whatever we practice will grow. Whatever we incline the mind frequently towards, does this the mind become? Does this become the shape of our mind? And so we see the delicacy of this inclining the mind, you know? And what is often so habitual is turned into being unhabitual through mindfulness. Mindfulness and habit do not coexist. They do not coexist. We need to learn to be so careful about where our minds are inclining, really every moment of the day, not just episodically, you know, not just periodically, but actually just really that commitment to actually changing the shape of our mind. And changing the shape of our mind, not through forcing, not through willpower, but through understanding, through kindness, through compassion. You know, bearing in mind the sutta we talked about yesterday, that this is concerned not only about ending our own affliction, but about being aware of ending the affliction of others and all. That's the primary motivation. There's always that sense of compassion and care. So the bhikkhus got it this time, you know. Fortunately, this elder was around to explain it, and they got it this time. And he cautions him, remember this. So the bhikkhus, as always, this is almost always happy endings in the discourses. Then the bhikkhus, delighted and rejoiced in Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Buddha. They sat down and they said what had taken place after he'd left and how all had been explained to him. And the Buddha said, Mahakachana is wise, bhikkhus. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and you should remember it. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came across a ball of honey in the course of eating it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, any able-minded bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, in the course of scrutinizing with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dharma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. What's the name of this teaching? And then the Blessed One said, as to that, Ananda, you may remember this teaching on the Dharma as the Honeyball Discourse. The taste of sweetness. Okay, so we're done. We've done what needs to be done. So thank you for your sustained attention over this very full weekend. And I hope it is useful. Thank you.